Where are we so far in the class? We've identified the central tension that lay at the heart of the Cold War. One great exception to this fundamental rule about how the two sides could live with each other, that each would call the shots in its side of the line of demarcation in Europe. There's one great exception to that. That has to do with West Germany. The Soviets cannot give the Western powers a totally free hand to do whatever they want in West Germany, because if they allow Germany to become too strong, too independent, to be too free to develop its military power, that will inevitably pose a threat to the system the Soviets established in East Germany in particular, Eastern Europe in general. Okay? So they have to be concerned. What this means for our purposes analytically is that if we want to understand both what the Cold War was about and whether there was any chance for ending the tensions associated with the Cold War and setting up a stable international system, we want to focus in on those periods when it seemed like a solution to the problem was within reach. So we looked at the Potsdam period, you know, at the understanding that Stalin and Burns had reached at Potsdam. Why didn't it work? Why does the Cold War break out in 1946? We talked about that. Then the next time, the second time, when it seemed that peace was within reach, a settlement was, at least the tacit settlement was within reach. That was 1949, the division of Europe, the formal division of Europe into blocs, the establishment of the two German states, the establishment of NATO. Why doesn't that work? And it doesn't work because the very next year, 1950-51, the world moves into a very scary crisis. We talked about that. And then finally, we focused on this third chance for peace. The 1954 system, a system established by the Paris Accords. It seemed that this was something everyone could live with. On the one hand, it provided a strong power base for balancing Soviet power in Europe, the NATO system, a system based on American power with an American military commander and so on. It solved the Russian problem, but it also solved the German problem. It solved the two great problems that lay at the heart of international political life. It kept the Germans from becoming too strong. It limited German power in all kinds of ways, both politically and militarily, and we talked about all this stuff, right? You'd think that this was a system that everyone could live with. Soviets could live with it because it solved their number one security problem in Europe, namely the control of German power. As long as Germany was relatively weak and dependent on her allies for protection, and as long as her allies were perfectly content to live with things as they were, a divided Europe, a divided Germany, Germany would be prevented from posing any threat to the Soviet sphere in the East. Soviets could live with it. You think also that the Germans could live with it because it solved their number one security problem, namely the Soviet threat. Germany was protected. That's the heart of it. But beyond that, it also meant that Germany was being integrated in the Western world, taken into the Western world as a partner, a kind of form of moral rehabilitation for the Germans, which meant an awful lot. Okay? But it's not sufficient that those two powers were willing to go along with it for this to be viable. Why not? And here's like a very fundamental point. It's like there is no purely European solution to the European security problem. They can't do it by themselves. They need the Americans to come in. It's only when the Americans come in that you can have an effective counterweight to Soviet power in Europe without posing a threat to the Soviet domination of Eastern Europe. You can't do it on a purely European basis because if Germany is weak, there's no effective counterweight to Soviet power. If Germany is strong, then the Soviet sphere in the East is threatened. Right? You need the Americans to interpose their power between the two sides and to, in effect, provide a kind of cushion that both sides are being protected, in a sense, both sides are being reassured. Right? The introduction of American power is fundamental to the stabilization of the status quo. That was why we think that the Paris Accords could have provided the basis for a viable international order. But they didn't work. Once again, the world moves into a second great period of crisis. This is the crisis that begins with Khrushchev's, the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev's, ultimatum about Berlin in November of 1958, which is the beginning of the great Berlin crisis of 1958 to 1962, a crisis which climaxes with the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962. This is the central episode of the Cold War. We're going to spend a lot of time analyzing this period from 58 to 62. Okay. The world moves into this second great period of crisis. Why? It's because of American policy. It's because the United States doesn't play the role that had been prescribed for it in the Paris Accords. Eisenhower and his Secretary of State Dulles did not like the Paris Accords. They did not want to be in Europe forever. They wanted to pull out. They wanted the Europeans to stand on their own. They had the, according to Eisenhower, the Europeans had the resources, the manpower needed to defend themselves. They should be ashamed of relying on America as their protector. He did not want Western Europe to be an American military protectorate. Right? The Americans weren't willing to play along. This was the heart of the problem. And if the Europeans were to stand on their own and not simply be protected by America, if America was to be able to withdraw from Europe, if Europe, to use Eisenhower's own phrase, was to be transformed into a third great power bloc in world affairs, capable of balancing the Soviets in Europe without direct American support, then the Europeans would need to be armed with nuclear weapons. There was no way you could stand up to a great nuclear power like the USSR without nuclear weapons of your own. And it's as obvious as can be. And so it was an integral part of the Eisenhower strategy for Europe. It was implicit in his fundamental strategic thinking that the Europeans should be armed with nuclear weapons. We should help them build. We should provide them with nuclear weapons. Because otherwise, they would never be able to defend themselves. And we would never be able to withdraw. We're not a great imperial power, according to Eisenhower. He wants to pull out. This is not a policy that you should be contemptuous of. It's based on this whole notion that you want to treat your allies like grown-ups. You don't want to infantilize them. You don't want to be the world's gendarme or anything like that. Right? That's the Eisenhower strategy. It implies the arming of Europeans with nuclear weapons. But given that there's no true pooling of sovereignty in Europe, no true United States of Europe, no true federal Europe, whatever European system came into being would be kind of like a loose confederation. You know, ultimately, power would reside with the national governments, in the national states, France, Britain, Germany, they would continue to exist, and even though they would cooperate with each other in some sort of overarching structure, like a NATO structure, the NATO structure would devolve into a European structure as the Americans withdrew their forces, as the NATO commander became a European general, and so on. And this is all things that Eisenhower wanted. Okay. Even though the Europeans would cooperate with each other in that structure, still, fundamentally, control of nuclear weapons would be in the hands of the national governments, and in particular in the hands of the German government. And for Eisenhower, this was not a problem. And his reasoning is very interesting here, because he's more of a realist than other people. Right? The whole realist philosophy is you shouldn't care about the distinct national characteristics of any particular country. The whole realist philosophy is what really matters is the political conjuncture, the political environment within which a state finds itself. That's what shapes its policy. And Eisenhower, when a lot of people in the American government, they don't like the idea of Germany getting their hands on nuclear weapons. They don't trust the Germans. Look at World War I. Look especially at World War II. You know, Eisenhower says, I don't agree with that at all. Saying, it's true Germany was a problem in the past, but that was only because Russia was weak. Now that Russia is strong, I will take a strong Germany. That's his view. That's straight power political reasoning, straight realist reasoning, right? No reason to prevent the Germans from going nuclear any more than there is to prevent the French or the British from going nuclear. This whole notion that the United States was from the start dead set against other countries acquiring nuclear weapons, that an anti-proliferation policy came into being at the very outset of the nuclear age, nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, all this stuff was suppressed when American policy did change in 1961, and the Americans opposed the whole idea of a German nuclear capability very strongly, and that was one of the great taproots of the new concern that began in the 1960s with what came to be called nuclear proliferation. The very term proliferation has a negative connotation. It wasn't used before the 1960s. 1950s, the term was nuclear sharing, which has a positive connotation. We should help these people. They're allies of ours. You can't treat them like enemies if you expect them to be allies. You can't show that you distrust them. All right, so we looked at the Eisenhower nuclear sharing policy. It's three great taproots. This fundamental Eisenhower concept, the whole strategy for the defense of Europe adopted by NATO in December of 54, called MC48. You should all know what that is by now. A strategy that plays very, very, very heavy emphasis on nuclear weapons, both tactically and strategically. And also this whole idea that America's ability to provide that nuclear umbrella, to threaten to escalate to the level of general nuclear war if the Soviets pushed too hard, that wasn't going to last forever. It was, the term at the time was, it was a wasting asset, American strategic superiority. It was bound to decline. And when the American nuclear umbrella no longer was, credible, then you needed something in its place. You needed the Europeans to be able to provide a direct deterrent, to not have to rely on what would become increasingly unbelievable American threats to bring down the whole temple. So they embarked on this policy of nuclear sharing. And it was proceeding apace, and the Europeans were being armed with American nuclear weapons, not in a direct way, because there was a law in place, the Atomic Energy Act, that said you weren't supposed to do this. So they did it in an indirect way. They made sure that American custody was purely nominal, purely technical, very easy to just sweep away in a time of crisis. All deliberate. The Europeans had effective control of these weapons by the end of the Eisenhower period. Hundreds of these things, the Europeans, including the Germans. Right? How are Soviets to react? Right? This is the whole issue of why do we move into a new period of crisis? What is the origin of the Great Berlin Crisis that breaks out in November of 1948? How are the Soviets to react to this? Well, they saw it was coming. I should say their intelligence sources were very good. And you expect this to be the case, by the way, in a divided country like Germany, where it was very easy for people to move in those days between East Germany and West Germany. All you have to do is go to East Berlin and take the subway from East Berlin to West Berlin, and then you can fly from West Berlin to West Germany. So it was very easy for the communist authorities in East Germany, working with the Soviets, to place operatives of theirs in the West German establishment. They were as German as anyone else. they automatically had the right to citizenship in West Germany. And in that way, they had very good intelligence information about what was being contemplated and what was going on. NATO itself was penetrated by Soviet agents. You know, other countries in NATO, France and Italy especially, had very large communist parties in those days. You know, like 1 in 4, 1 in 5 of voters voted communist. A lot of scientists were communists, for example, nuclear scientists. Soviets knew what was going on. What were they to do about it? Well, in the mid-50s, they tried to head it off by proposing a nuclear-free zone in Central Europe. You know, the two Germanys, Poland, Czechoslovakia, they shouldn't have nuclear weapons. Maybe no nuclear weapons should be deployed in those areas at all. This was rejected by the West because of the strategy that placed such emphasis on nuclear weapons for the defense of Europe. You're not going to strip yourself bare of the one weapon that you're counting on to defend yourself. So the West, with the exception of the British, were not very interested in these disengagement plans, as they were called, or plans for nuclear-free zones and so on. And so as a last resort, the Soviets resorted to what Khrushchev's foreign policy advisor at that time, later in the after the Cold War in his memoirs, referred to as shock therapy. This guy's named Troyanovsky. What finally impelled Khrushchev to resort to what today might be called shock therapy, he wrote, was information from various sources that serious discussions were proceeding within the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and in particular between the United States and West Germany, regarding the possibility of the Bundeswehr, the German army, the Bundeswehr is being granted access to atomic weapons in one form or another. All right? Indeed, this is something that touched a very raw nerve on the side of the Soviets. This is something that they very much wanted to head off. A German nuclear capability, a Germany with her finger on the nuclear trigger. How are you going to do it? The soft approach had failed, the approach of diplomacy. Well, you got to resort to shock therapy. And what's the lever? What's the obvious lever that the Soviets have for forcing the Western powers to take their concerns about Germany seriously? What's the lever that they used in 1948 when the West set about creating a West German state? It's just like, look at the map. It's as obvious as can be. Here you have West Berlin, half of the city of Berlin. You know, tied to the West in all kinds of ways, protected by the presence there of forces, military forces of the three Western powers, the United States, Britain, and France. And West Berlin, there it is, right in the middle of communist East Germany, over 100 miles from the inter-German border. Very easy to put pressure on the West by threatening the status of Berlin, threatening to cut off Berlin. That's what they had done in 48. And now Khrushchev opts for this tactic. What is the Soviet goal? Well, the claim is, my claim is, that the concern about West Germany becoming a nuclear power was the taproot of what? Of the Soviet decision to, trigger a crisis over Berlin. What's the basis for that? Well, part of it is just theoretical. You know, this fundamental notion that in international politics, as in other areas of life, for that matter, fear is a more powerful emotion than greed. Countries are willing to take greater risks because of things that they're afraid of, rather than simply out of a desire to pluck a certain gain. The thing is, yeah, but that's a theoretical assumption. So how do you go about nailing it down? Well, you look at the other possible interpretations of Soviet policy during the crisis. Why else would the Soviets have provoked this? Because they wanted a war? Of course not. This is still a period of great American nuclear superiority, 1958. Perhaps not quite as great as it had been in 1954 because the Soviets were building, but they were still quite vulnerable to an American first strike. They don't want a war. And in fact, they wouldn't have behaved as they did if they didn't want a war. Because what exactly was Khrushchev laying down, threatening in this so-called ultimatum that he gave in November of 1958? What is the basic argument there? It's like, he says, well, over a decade has passed since the end of the war. The time has come to stabilize things in Europe, to achieve a formal peace settlement in Europe. And when that happens, these kind of relics of the war that are just anomalies nowadays, like the Western presence in West Berlin, a relic of the occupation regime, this is going to have to end. And he says, but normally it would be natural for West Berlin to be absorbed into East Germany. That's where it was located. But we understand that there are special considerations that kind of militate against that. And so what we're proposing is that the West should negotiate with us and transform the status of West Berlin into a free city. West Berlin should become a free city. The Western military contingents would be withdrawn, but West Berlin would continue as before with her existing social and economic order. This is the claim, this is a very generous thing we're doing. And if and we'll give the Western power 6 months to negotiate a settlement on that basis, transferring West Berlin into a free city. November 58, this is. And if the West doesn't do it within 6 months, then we'll do things unilaterally. We'll sign a peace treaty with East Germany, and when that happens, the occupation regime will have ended. The rights of the three Western powers as occupying powers in Germany, their rights with regard to Berlin will be liquidated. And if the West has the nerve to try and maintain these rights through the use of military force, well, we will rise in defense of our East German ally. In other words, he's threatening war. Threatening war if the West doesn't give in to his demand that they withdraw their military forces from Berlin, knowing full well that this is something the West is not going to want to do. Right. So what's the goal? What's the goal, yeah?
Besides the optics of the whole situation, why didn't the West like proactively find a way to get out of Berlin? If all the resources were in West Germany, what would they have really lost? But they would have gained, like, the Soviet Union not having this as a ploy.
Yeah, well, in 1948, there were a lot of people, not dovish types, military types, who made exactly that kind of argument. Eisenhower himself felt that this Berlin thing was crazy. That at the end of the war, he had argued with President Roosevelt that it was nuts to maintain this presence there. There was indefensible salient and so on. But the years had gone by, and we had made all of these promises, and Berlin had such symbolic importance, especially in Germany, but in the world as a whole, that for us to kind of pull out of Berlin with our tail between our legs, after having said all these things about how we're going to stand up for our rights there, and to kind of be treated as though we were of no account and humiliated in that way, well, our entire political position in Europe would collapse. We can't accept this. This is the feeling. We had invested so much in it that we can't do what, you know, you're suggesting, this kind of military rational thing of just withdrawing. We feel committed. And it's a question of self-respect, national pride. We're not going to, you know, pursue a craven policy of just handing over a couple million people to the communists. We have our rights. Those rights are going to be respected. That's the way people think about this stuff. Okay? What can we infer from the nature of the Berlin ultimatum? Well, they don't want a war. If you want a war, you're not going to give your adversary 6 months to prepare for it. It's clear they're using this as a lever. Another argument people sometimes make is that the Soviets wanted to push the Western powers out of Berlin. That Berlin was an embarrassment for them. that it served as a source of weakness for the communist regime there. You hear these arguments a lot. But it just wasn't the case. If they wanted to kind of force a withdrawal of the Western powers from Berlin, it was a very easy way for them to do that. It was by making West Berlin economically untenable. Because although they didn't have the right to interfere with like military convoys, and the convoys needed to supply the military garrisons in Berlin, it was quite clear that nothing would be done if civilian trade, civilian economic intercourse between Berlin and West Germany were cut off. And if that happened, then Berlin would become economically unviable. And this was a real source of concern for Eisenhower. He couldn't go to war, he felt, if the Soviets limited their measures that they took in Berlin to those that simply affected the civilian trade. And then this whole business about the status of the East German regime. Well, Berlin had this open border, like I say. You could just, in those days, just take the subway from one part of Berlin to the other. And what this meant was that a lot of the most skilled, most valuable citizens in East Germany would move to the West, where salaries were much higher, living conditions were much better, and so on, political conditions were much better. So there was this hemorrhage of their most highly trained, the most important segment of the population. And this was weakening the East German regime, and the fact that people could emigrate in that way was a great source of weakness. And the East German communists, as we now know, lobbied the Soviets, allow us to seal the border, allow us to prevent people from leaving. And the Soviets wanted to sustain the East German regime, they would have done it. Because it was clear the Western powers weren't going to go to war if they did so. Right? But they said to the East Germans, no, we're not going to do it because, in essence, because we have bigger fish to fry. Their real concern is not Berlin or East Germany, it's West Germany, and especially the whole question of West German power. That's why they kept this open. They wanted Berlin as a lever that they could use against the West, just as in 1948 they had done the same thing. Okay? How do the Western powers react to all of this? Why do you have a crisis? Right. They're not willing to be pushed out of Berlin. They're not willing to be dictated to. But they don't, under Eisenhower, they don't make a big deal about it. Eisenhower's catchword, his basic slogan here for managing the crisis, is that it's important to be firm but not truculent. Right? We'll do things in a low-key way to show the other side that we're tough and that we're willing to escalate to the level of war if necessary. Things that Soviet intelligence will pick up, but which were not so obvious as to alarm our own publics, right? This is the Eisenhower philosophy. We're not going to give way, but his whole feeling is, I don't like Berlin. I want to settle it. I want to enter into negotiations that will enable us to find some sort of modus vivendi, some way of managing the situation so that the two sides can live with it, right? But he's not a total free agent in these negotiations. He has to worry about his own allies, right? The notion is, well, in the final analysis, we can get our way, but an alliance based on America simply dictating to the Europeans, this is not going to be viable in the long run. We have to provide a somewhat broader basis for what we do. So a lot of what happens depends on whether the Allies are willing to go along with it. Americans are willing, you know, they're willing if push comes to shove, and if the Soviets follow through with their threats about Berlin, we're willing to use force here. Doesn't mean that they stop a couple of U.S. jeeps on the Autobahn going from West Germany into West Berlin, and then, you know, the expression was the balloon goes up and it's execute the PSYOP. The PSYOP is the basic plan for general nuclear war, the single integrated operational plan. Execute the PSYOP, and it's World War III. That was not the strategy. It was caricatured that way at the time and subsequently, but the basic idea of the Eisenhower strategy is you start with a relatively small probes at the platoon level, and then you gradually raise the level of military force that you're willing to use, going up to the level of a full reinforced division, which is a serious force. And then if the other side, you know, fires on that and prevents that force from moving into Berlin, then that means that there's no dealing with these people. We're not going to accept defeat over this, and it's execute the PSYOP, World War III. That's the Eisenhower strategy. Not that different from the Kennedy strategy that followed it, as we'll see. All right, that's the Americans are tough, even though they want negotiations. But the core is tough. We're not going to surrender our rights here. Okay. We're not going to engage in a policy of appeasement. What about the European allies? Well, the British take a very soft line on all of this. They don't want war for Berlin. They're basically willing to give away an awful lot to the Soviets. As a matter of fact, the British Prime Minister, Conservative Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, he flies over to Moscow in March of 1959 to try and act as a mediator. He's totally humiliated there by the Soviets. And British policy is discredited in the eyes, not just of the Americans, but of the two chief continental allies, France and West Germany. West Germany, their strategy is being set by their chancellor, the great founding chancellor of the Federal Republic, Konrad Adenauer. Adenauer refuses to give anything verbally. But this doesn't mean that at the core of the policy is tough, because even though he's not willing to enter into negotiations, meaningful negotiations that would sacrifice anything to the other side, if the other side uses force, Germans are against replying in kind. They don't want to use force. They're too weak to use conventional force. They feel the West is too weak for that. And when our Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, goes over to Europe at the beginning of 1959 to talk with the Europeans about how to handle this, he has this meeting with Adenauer. And Adenauer says, well, what do you do if Berlin is cut off and all these measures of limited use of force were insufficient to kind of reopen access to the city? Dulles says, well, of course we'll use nuclear weapons. And Adenauer looks at him and says, you know, this in the words of the American State Department official, David Klein, who was translator there, he says, you know, Adenauer says, for God's sake, not for Berlin. No nuclear war for Berlin. And the Americans felt like you can't have it both ways. You can't take an intransigent line of negotiations and then say, in the event of war, we're not going to do anything. It didn't add up. So there was a lot of American pressure that was put on Adenauer. And there was give in the German position on all these issues having to do with how much status were you going to give the East German regime? How much recognition were you going to give the East German regime? And will you accept the East Germans as people who could kind of look at your papers and so on as when you were sending convoys through to the city, that sort of thing? But on one issue, Adenauer was utterly intransigent, and this was the issue of German nuclear weapons. Adenauer wanted a German nuclear force. There's just absolutely no doubt about this on the basis of evidence that's become available in the last 20 years. All this stuff was suppressed at the time. But Adenauer actually said in the German cabinet meeting in 1956 when this issue came up about should Germany have nuclear forces under her own control. He said, you know, we must produce them. We must produce them ourselves. A lot of stuff along those lines. Okay? And the Americans were unwilling to put any serious pressure on Adenauer on this issue. As a matter of fact, quite the reverse. Because the mere fact now that you had a real risk of war meant that the West had to be as strong as possible. The West had to prepare for a war. And this meant that all of the Western armies, not just the Americans, but the others, the Germans as well, had to be armed with nuclear weapons. Weapons which were effectively under their own control. And so this is the story of the mid-1950s. Americans were moving ahead with the preparing of the Bundeswehr to use these American nuclear weapons. Right? And with the prospect of war, you didn't want to kind of stop that from going on. As a matter of fact, you wanted to accelerate the pace of these preparations, get the Germans, pull the Germans closer to getting a finger on the trigger, precisely because there was a crisis. So on the core issue here, the issue of will Germany have nuclear weapons? There was no real give on the part of the Western side, on the part of the Americans or the Germans. Okay. Still, given what the Adenauer policy was, it was not a particularly good idea for the Americans to be in a situation where they would simply have to lay down the law to the Europeans, although they could if they wanted. And it was of very great importance in this context that the French were willing, in this early phase of the Berlin crisis, to take a stand that was pretty much in line with what the Americans wanted. This is the France of General Charles de Gaulle, who had just come back to power in the spring of 1958. Right? And this is this great crisis that he has to deal with. And his whole feeling is very similar to the Americans. We can't give way to the Soviets on this whole issue. We can't demonstrate weakness like that. If so, our whole political system is going to collapse. Maybe in the final analysis, we're going to have to make serious concessions, but not at the start. We have to show some backbone, or else everything is going to collapse. And so the French basically aligned their policies with the Americans, and this gave the Eisenhower policy a somewhat broader base than it otherwise would have, at least ostensibly. We weren't just imposing our views on the Europeans. Okay. So then what? So you have this crisis. The Soviets are trying to use Berlin as a lever. The Americans are resisting, although in a fairly low-key way. We want negotiations. Why do we want negotiations, by the way? Because we know that our nuclear advantage is not going to last forever. We know that sooner or later the Soviets are going to develop survivable nuclear forces. They don't. What survives an American first strike doesn't have to be all that large. In a world where 40 or 50 thermonuclear weapons could destroy even the largest countries like America and Russia, destroy them as functioning societies if they're placed on the right targets. Right? We know this world is coming. It's taking longer to come than people thought for kind of reasons that I'll probably talk about next time. But we know it's coming. And when it comes, our position in Berlin is going to become indefensible. We can sustain it, obviously not through conventional forces, no matter how large they are. We can sustain it only through the threat of nuclear escalation, which is credible only as long as we enjoy nuclear superiority, as long as executing that threat would not be suicidal. If it eventually will be suicidal, now's the time to negotiate a settlement that everybody could live with. Now's the time to cash in on the advantages we now have, our strategic superiority. That's the thinking during the Eisenhower period. And for that reason, Eisenhower does not want to push the Soviets to the wall and humiliate them and just bring the crisis to a head. They want to defuse the crisis. And then, you know, you call conferences, and finally Khrushchev is invited to the United States, and he makes a visit to meet with Eisenhower in Camp David in September of 1959. An interesting meeting, because Khrushchev kind of proposes, in a backhanded way, something which amounts to a settlement, but Eisenhower is totally deaf to this proposal. How does he do this? The Soviets are beginning to have problems with China. And Khrushchev basically says to the Americans, oh, there's an inconsistency in your policy, Germany versus China. You're willing to accept the two China's policy, but you're not willing to accept the two Germany's policy. And basically, the implication is, can't we make a deal on that basis? Both of us will accept the two Germany's policy, and both of us will accept the two China's policy. You know, basically, Soviets burning their bridges with China, but reaching a kind of understanding with the United States. Eisenhower doesn't quite grasp what's going on, and he says to Khrushchev, his answer is, well, yeah, international politics gets a little complicated at times. That's it. Right. So Camp David doesn't lead to any settlement at all, September 59, and it seems that the Soviets are going to bring up the issue again, and it looks like there's the crisis is going to come to a head in 1960. And there's this pressure to head it off. A summit conference is scheduled for Paris for May of 1960, but it becomes clear that the summit conference is not going to succeed, meaning that there's a good chance of war. And given that there's a good chance of war, we need to get good target intelligence about where the Soviet missiles and bombers are so that we could hit them in a first strike. And that means we have to send these reconnaissance aircraft, the famous U-2 spy plane, over the Soviet Union to take photographs of Soviet territory to see what the targets are. That's why you have the U-2 overflights. And the Soviets take advantage of that. They shoot down one of these planes and use this as an excuse for, you know, breaking the Paris summit, although there was no chance that the summit would have achieved anything anyway. Okay, so that's... the collapse of the summit doesn't lead to a new Berlin crisis, to people's surprise. The Soviets aren't going to threaten war given their strategic inferiority vis-a-vis the United States. So the whole thing is put on hold, and they wait until there's a change of administration to heat the thing up again and see what they can get from the new Democratic administration. Because Kennedy is elected in November of 1960 and takes office in January of 61. And it's during the Kennedy period, 61 to 63, that very important developments take shape, which ultimately lead to a resolution of these fundamental conflicts that lay at the heart of the Cold War. So that's what I'll be talking about next time. Okay, see you there. Okay.